Midwest Higher Education Compact. And joined by Mr. Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Larry Isaac. I'm president of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. It's a pleasure to be here today. Thank you for having us. You've asked us to give you a briefing on the compact and its activities, specifically in Minnesota, and what we are doing. With me is Chris Rasmussen, who is our vice president for policy. Chris will visit with you about another item you're interested in, our Midwest CREST initiative, and he'll explain what that is. Also with me is Pam Schutt, who I think many of you know. Pam is our deputy and director of state relations. You have in front of you a folder, which I'm going to only highlight a couple of items from and be brief about the compact's activities, and then turn it over to Chris for a few minutes. On the right-hand side, and there's a lot of information in here about the compact and our services. I'm not going to go through all the documents, but on the right-hand side of your folder is a one-page document, which is our MEC in Minnesota. As I think most of you know, our offices are located right here in Minneapolis-St. Paul. The compact was created in 1991. There are four of these regional compacts in the country. This one was created in 1991, about 40 to 50 years after the other compacts had been created. And our primary mission is to advance cooperation and resource sharing in higher education. The compact is located here because Minnesota, at the time the compact was created, put forth a very concerted effort to have the compact headquartered in Minnesota. The University of Minnesota was a very strong participant in those discussions, and at the present time, we are located on the University of Minnesota campus in a building there, and they provide very reasonable terms for us to rent space and are very supportive. So I thought you ought to know that about why we're located here. And we're glad we are. We serve 12 states in the compact in the Midwest region, from Michigan down through Missouri and up through Kansas and the Dakotas and over east to Wisconsin and everything in between. All of the states have passed statutes to be members of the compact, so it is a true interstate compact. That statute is very important in working with the states, since it creates the MEC as a body corporate of each state. So we're able to do things on behalf of the states with our commission's approval. The commission, which governs the compact, is comprised of five people from each state. The compact statutes require that two of those be legislators. Senator Pappas and Representative Rukavina are the commissioners from Minnesota. And then three people are appointed by governors or named in the statutes that the states have. In Minnesota, those people are Chancellor McCormick, Robert Jones, Executive Vice President at the University of Minnesota, and also Tim Morin, who is a private entrepreneur, just been appointed by the governor, but also serves on the Independent or the Private College Association Board. So we have the connection of all the different higher education
Mr. Isaac,
leadership.
I think we had David Laird at one point.
That's correct. That's correct. And then David, of course, when he left his position, resigned his position as commissioner as well. There are also a number of people who serve on our committees who oversee our programs. We have at any one time up to 200 people who are involved in guiding and developing our programs to carry out that mission of collaboration and resource sharing. We have great participation from Minnesota being located here. We sometimes call on folks in the Minnesota State College and University system and from the University of Minnesota even more so than we might in other states, just because they're here and they've been very supportive and helpful with us. Early on, the commission that governs this compact decided that one of the areas that they wanted to emphasize with the compact was the part of our mission involved with resource sharing. And so this is the only compact of higher ed compacts of those four that really focuses on the resource sharing part. And perhaps, I think, maybe the only compact in the country of any kind that has this as a focus. And what that means, what resource sharing means, is really using the leverage, the capacity of the 12 states to enter into contracts and negotiations of various products and services that, when you use all of that capacity and leverage, can reduce costs. And so that has been a significant part of our work from early stages on. Now, what this has meant over the years, if you'll take the document behind that one pager that looks like this with the Minnesota map up in the corner on your right-hand side, the document behind the one pager. Okay, and if you turn to page 6 and 7, there are two charts in there that you will see. Over the years, we have been in and out of a lot of programs that have saved money. We don't stay in things if they're no longer useful. For example, we used to have a telecommunications program when telephone rates were 25 cents for long distance. Well, that no longer is applicable, and we're not in that anymore. But right now, a focus is in technology and property insurance. In the property insurance area, that program has now grown to insure $66 billion at over 100 campuses and is now growing to be a national program in scope, which even leverages the program further. The University of Minnesota was a founding member of that program and has been an active participant, and over the years has saved under that program close to $9 million. And so you can see that it has provided significant savings for the University of Minnesota. It has for all of the other institutions as well that participate in it. We also have a strong program in technology that institutions can use. And in technology, many of those programs are also available to state and local governments and school districts. And we see heavy usage among school districts and state and local governments in particular because of their size in many cases, because there's no way they can, with their size, sometimes get the kinds of deals that we can when we leverage the 12 states' capacity. In Minnesota, last year, there were about $6 million of purchases off of those technology contracts. I'm pleased to report to you that this year, the usage in Minnesota is even growing. It has been steadily growing, but it seems to be growing very well this year. In the first 6 months of this year, entities in Minnesota have purchased about $4.5 million off of those contracts. So if that pace continued, there'd be a very nice growth in the use of those contracts. Let me just give you an example. In the last 6 months, Cass County, the amount of their purchases were $54,000. Dakota County Library, $72,000. University of Minnesota, there's many, many instances here. They seem to be looking to use us more, and we're very glad for that. Hennepin County Sheriff, $70,000. And I could go on and on and on with the kind of entities. In addition, the Minnesota State College and University entities use us in various capacities as well. So Minnesota continues to benefit very strongly. Last year, if you would compare the amount that states pay, they pay $95,000. Each state pays $95,000 a year to be a member of the compact. That's the lowest of all the compacts in a significant way across the country. But if you compared that to the savings that were accrued under these programs, the rate of return on that would be 26 to 1. So we think that's a pretty good rate of return given the amount that you pay. And we thank you for your support from this committee for maintaining that payment. We try to be very careful with that payment. As Senator Pappas knows, that payment is set, and it's not going to change, and it's going to be the same for 5 years. And before that, it was the same for 3 or 4 years. So it just doesn't automatically go up. It is looked at very importantly, and we try to live within those means without raising our rates as we move forward. In addition, in the cost savings area, we have two new initiatives that are being explored and implemented. One is in the area of energy conservation. We think this has significant promise. This is what our states and entities told us they wanted us to focus on. So there will be a number of contracts negotiated with vendors in the area of energy conservation, windows, eventually solar panels, light bulbs, things like that that we need on an everyday basis and that cost a lot of money for campuses. We're not going to get into energy buying. We've tried that. 10 years ago, as I understand, before I came on board, and it was just too complicated of an area to cross state lines trying to do all of that. The other is in health insurance, and specifically at the present time, we are working on a student health insurance program that would cut across all 12 states. We think if we could get capacity there that we might be able to get insurance companies to perhaps get some good buys for students on health insurance. Of course, that all depends on what happens in Washington over the next month or two and how all of that will set. And then we also may look at, in just terms of medical costs, in some specific areas that campuses have to buy or purchase products in, for example, pharmaceuticals. We know Ohio State has done something there that's been very significant. The second area of focus that I want to mention that our commission has guided us into is in what we call student access. We have a student exchange program there that Minnesota participates in, many of the institutions participate in, that allows people to move among the states at reduced non-resident tuition among the states. 8 of the states participate in that program. There are about 3,500 students that take advantage of that. Saves students about $4,400 a year. That's a lot. Last year it saved students across the Midwest about $14 million. And that's quite a pocketbook issue. We also have a number of programs where we try to make it convenient for students to find ways to attend college. We have an electronic transcript initiative that Minnesota, through the Office of Higher Education, has participated in, where just students can transfer their transcripts from high school to college electronically. That program is growing in use in Minnesota by school districts. And that just saves a lot of time and effort on everybody's part when you can do that.
Mr. Isaac, I'm told that it is far more easier for students to transfer their records to colleges than to transfer records from one high school to another high school, especially if it's,
right?
You know, outside of district.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, a lot of that is because of your efforts
that
e-transcript.
Yeah. It really is something for the students, and we know that's where most students, the world they live in, is on the on the net and using the network and all of that for what they do. The third area that we are involved in that the commission has asked us to be involved in is policy research and analysis for...
Mr. Isaac, before you go into policy and research, I did have a question for you. Getting back to the whole issue of joint purchasing, what you said that there's some growth in that area, but what have been some of the barriers? Why are some... you know, entities, local government, colleges, whatever, why do they not participate?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, what we find is just getting the word out, getting them to know that they can use MEC. We're not a household name in many quarters, so it's getting the word out. Secondly, understanding that they can purchase off of it without going to bid themselves, which saves them a lot of time and money, because we have negotiated this on behalf of the states and the statute permits that to happen. And so they don't have to go out and bid. So understanding that they can use it is another thing. And thirdly, what we're seeing a bit of in these tight budget times, that sometimes there's a tendency for entities to pull inward rather than to look outward for solutions. And we see some protectionism going on, and I'm seeing a little bit more of that during these difficult times. Even though the growth, our programs continue to grow across most of the states, there is a tendency we're finding for people to be, well, we've got to show that we can do it ourselves to show our worth, if you will, rather than saying, well, we've got an outside solution that could save us time on bidding and money and so forth and costs and so forth. We're not the solution for everybody all of the time. If the institutions sometimes can go out, especially larger entities sometimes can go out and do some things specifically with a vendor under you know, a separate contract. So we're not the solution all the time, but many times we can be the solution for entities. But sometimes that is a barrier, the understanding that they can use it, and secondly, just sometimes protectionism, wanting to do it yourself.
All right. As bulk purchasing, is that a strategy that some of our college campuses can use to help them in these difficult budget times?
Well, I think so. And I know that one of our people that works with us, for instance, in a couple of weeks, I just found out this morning, is having a meeting with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and a number of people from there. They want to take a harder look at how they can use MEC's programs and services as part of their strategy. So, absolutely. And that's what we find. In Michigan, for example, they even put in their statute encouraging colleges and universities to use MEC.
Mm-hmm.
Put it right in their statute. The legislature did, you know, giving a signal to that regard. It's not even something we sought. It just happened, and because they saw it as a good thing, for example. Okay.
Any questions on the purchasing issues? Okay, then why don't you continue?
Our third area of emphasis to carry out that mission of cooperation and resource sharing is in the policy area. We try to be very practical in this area. We're trying to carve ourselves out as a practical, offering practical ideas and solutions to policymakers and colleges and universities. We do that in a number of ways through best practices publications. In your document here, there are a number of charts and graphs that we do for each state, which shows trends on college completion, persistence, funding, financing, financial aid. I'm not going to go through all of those that you can use to gauge how you're doing in comparison to other states and internationally. We also do this through a convening process of an annual policy summit a year, every year, bringing together legislators, higher education leaders, business leaders, and others in one room. So not everybody is in silos. And
what was the topic last year in North Dakota, and what do you think the topic will be next year?
Well, the topic last year really focused on college success, because the emphasis is really shifting in the policy arena to not just enrolling students, but to helping students to succeed. And so that was the emphasis on it, and we looked at some states that are doing some things in policy work, some practical examples from campuses that are doing some things to improve college success and college completion rates. And I think as policymakers, you're going to continue to hear a lot more about that whole issue of not just getting them in the door, but getting people out the door successfully, and what might be the barriers or what might be some policy actions to take in that regard. And I know that there are things that are being done here in Minnesota within the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and the University of Minnesota as a focus as well. So,
Mr. Isaac, yeah. Did the idea for CREST come out of that policy seminar?
It did. Well, no, it was really started to be envisioned. I'll let Chris tell you about the evolution of it. It confirmed our belief that it was the right thing to do.
Okay.
And so one of the areas, for example, is this initiative called CREST that is under our policy umbrella. And I'm going to turn it over to Chris Rasmussen to talk about that. It's been getting a lot of play lately, as some of you may have seen from the Gates Foundation, which is helping to fund the exploration. One of the senior officers there used it as an example at a very large conference the other day of a very innovative approach to serving students, adult students. So, Chris, take it away.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Rasmussen, would you just state your name for the record?
Sure. I'm Chris Rasmussen, Vice President for Research and Policy Analysis with the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. Thank you, Senator Pappas, for the opportunity to be here. Just want to take a few minutes to explain, share with you some details about an initiative that's just underway. About 4 years ago, we decided that we wanted to do something in the area of transfer and articulation. We had received feedback from some of our commissioners and just reading the tea leaves and the research and sort of the political winds that the area of students being able to transfer seamlessly between and among institutions while minimizing the amount of credits that they lose in the process was a pretty important one. And so this eventually wound its way into a proposal to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which was funded in the amount of $100,000. And we've got a sheet in the folder that describes this, which we call the Midwest CREST, or the Credential Repository for Education, Skills, and Training. The impetus of this really is the need to expand the pool of human capital in this country in order to remain competitive economically in a global world. President Obama, the Lumina Foundation, the Gates Foundation, all have set benchmarks in the 50 to 60% range of adults that require a post-secondary credential in order for the United States to remain competitive into the foreseeable future. This is particularly critical in the Midwest, particularly the eastern part of the region, states like Michigan and Ohio, Indiana, which have historically been reliant on heavy manufacturing for the bulk of their economy and their employment. Individuals that are lacking post-secondary credentials at greater rates than we have in places like Minnesota and Iowa and North Dakota. We know we can't meet these objectives just by getting more students to graduate from high school to go directly to college and to complete college. Even if we were to expand those numbers and improve those rates pretty significantly, we would still fall short of that benchmark. So the only way to reach that is to go after that significant pool of individuals that have started college at some point in their lives and stopped, and perhaps started again and stopped, sometimes in multiple iterations of that at multiple institutions. We know there's at least 2.5 million individuals over the age of 25 in the Midwest that fit that criteria. It becomes more and more difficult the longer you've been out of school and the more institutions that you've attended to be able to translate that into a degree. We also know that there's lots of people out there that have valuable learning experiences that come not from formal academic programs, but from work, from non-credit training, from certificate programs, military experience, and other kinds of legitimate experiential activities that might be translatable into college credit because they represent competencies that have been developed that are competencies that are expected of college graduates. There are institutions, certainly, and systems that try to address this through various articulation and transfer initiatives. It becomes complicated when you've got individuals with such a diverse range of attendance patterns. They're starting school later in life. They maybe took a few classes 10 or 15 years ago. They're attending multiple institutions in multiple states. We know that 60% of individuals that graduate with a bachelor's degree have attended two or more institutions. And of that group, 25% have attended institutions in two or more states. The interstate attendance patterns really complicate matters when it comes to trying to merge all of these things into one program. We estimate that the lost credits that come from individuals trying to transfer and find that their whole record does not transfer can be estimated at about $10 billion annually across the country. So what we proposed to Gates was a program that would be based using a web-based platform that would essentially be a portfolio platform that would enable individuals to take all of their earned credits from various institutions, as well as all of their experience that they believe have value from a learning standpoint that can be translated into college credits, to put those into some sort of a package and make a deposit of sorts into this repository. That would be documented, organized into some sort of a standard transcript, which would then be made available to colleges and universities who wanted to participate that could assess the value of these portfolios relative to their own curricular frameworks and their own degree requirements, and make a bid or an offer of what that would be worth at that college or institution in terms of credits and the classes that it would cover, and what it would take to bring that portfolio up to the level of a degree, whether it was an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. Institutions may propose a series of classes that are done in the classroom or online, competency assessments, testing out of classes, residencies, other kinds of experiences, and a student would be able to assess all of these offers, make a decision as to which one was most attractive based on cost, flexibility, accessibility, time to degree, whatever. So imagine a scenario where colleges and universities compete for the opportunity to complete a student's degree rather than a student pleading with institutions to accept their previous credits and recognize their prior learning. So this is an exploratory grant. It's a proof of concept grant. It involves a few major components. One is to inventory existing technologies and technological requirements with such a platform. to assess state institutional-level practices and related policies. We certainly don't want to start from scratch. We're not trying to recreate the wheel. We want to enhance and provide additional value to what institutions and states are already doing. Need to assess needs and potential utilization of the platform by degree seekers, as well as colleges and universities that might participate, and then identification of the scope and mark and type of marketing and outreach that would be required to generate sufficient knowledge and use of the platform, development of a business model, identification of the kinds of resources that would be needed to both get it running and sustain it over time, and a series of recommendations that we would then make to our board in November and to the Gates Foundation about how we might proceed. We do have two major partners in the Institute, one being the Institute for Academic Alliances at Kansas State University, and also the Brookings Institution's Great Lakes Economic Initiative, which has taken this on really as an economic development initiative related to improved interstate mobility of human capital throughout the Midwest region. So I'm happy to take any questions folks may have about this. We're in the very beginning stages of the exploratory process with a lot of the beginning research really being done by our colleagues at Kansas State University.
Madam Chair, one additional comment.
Mr. Isaac.
The estimate is that there are about 2.25 to 2.5 million people in this situation in our 12 Midwestern states. Just think about that, 2.25 to 2.5 million people. If we could even reach 5% of those through something like this. In Minnesota, it's estimated somewhere between, I think, 300 to 330,000 people in this situation. That's a lot of people that hopefully we could serve. Now, there are some entities and campuses that are already doing this on their own in different ways, but this could become a one-stop shop, if you will, for our citizens who want to pursue this. So there's quite a market out there.
It's very, very, very intriguing. I feel in some ways that I was one of those students because I had gone to at least two institutions and was able to complete my degree at Metropolitan State because they were – took my credits and also were evaluated life experience and helped me get my degree of completion. So it sounds very similar. Okay, so right now, though, a lot of our colleges, at least in Minnesota, are very overprescribed. I don't know how they are in other states. So what kind of institutions do you think will participate? Do you have any sense of that, Mr. Rasmussen?
We would imagine, and this is based on related types of initiatives that have been done by other organizations, that the first institutions that would participate would be the for-profits, those that have a heavy presence online, those who have experience being entrepreneurial and that have made a name for themselves and developed a standard practice in doing prior learning assessment, recognizing the various ways that individuals gain college-level competencies, that are used to assessing transcripts from multiple institutions. And so we expect that that would be the brunt of the first set of institutions that would participate. There would need to be an incentive on the part of institutions really to see this as an opportunity for them to expand their pool of undergraduates to perhaps obtain some additional revenue through the opportunity to complete degrees.
It might be a nice niche for some of our rural campuses. I know many of them are already heavily online, 25-40%
right.
online, and this could be another opportunity for them.
I would agree with that, yep.
Yeah. Okay. We think there's some community colleges, perhaps those in rural areas, four-year institutions, baccalaureate degree institutions that, again, in more rural areas and so forth and so on, that might be struggling with enrollment.
Right.
And those types of things might step into the fray, as well as independent colleges. You also, we've also had some interest. I was at the University of Missouri here a week and a half ago, and the registrar came and approached me and said, "We're very interested in this approach." They have a new president there who's very significantly into outreach and into that whole arena and creative non-traditional ways of serving people. And so we've been approached by an institution, a land-grant institution of that size. So I think we'll see some of those want to play as well.
As well as places like Metro State that do have a certain level of expertise in that area already and might be able to bring that to a greater scale.
So is the what's the future then with the Gates Foundation? Once you complete the proof of concept, as you called it, stage, then what's the next stage?
Well, the grant runs through December 31st, and so our plan is to have the brunt or the bulk of the research done by early November so we can present this to our commission for approval, recommendations then that we would make to the Gates Foundation through a standard reporting mechanism, I would imagine, and then it would be, I think, up to Gates to determine if it's something they wanted to fund in the next phase. So that might mean going the next step in terms of developing a pilot structure and looking for some funding to then institute a pilot. And then perhaps the third phase would be a full rollout. There are some related initiatives that are going on with the Council for Adult and Experiential Education in Chicago, as well as the American Council on Education. And Mr. Isaac and I were in Washington 2 weeks ago to meet with representatives of those organizations to see where our initiatives overlapped and where there might be some collaborative opportunities. So there's a recognition that the other players are out there that are seeing the same problem and are approaching it in similar ways. How can we leverage the unique strengths of all the organizations that are out there to provide something that we believe have a mutual interest in helping to bring resolution to?
Okay, thank you very much, and
thank
appreciate you coming today.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Tomasoni.
Before they leave, you allowed me to substitute for you in Fargo, and so I was at the conference in Fargo, and I think it's well worth it if anybody gets a chance. I don't know if you let anybody come that's in the legislature, just the commissioners can go, but it was pretty good. And in fact, we went to the Microsoft facility there. I think that's when they presented the check, right, for the $100,000.
That's right.
And
yeah.
It was.
That's where Gates presented their check.
Yeah,
that's where we announced it.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah.
It was. Are there 1,900 people working in that facility for Microsoft? And
yes.
I think they do. They do all of Microsoft's accounting right in Fargo because they get good Midwestern help from good Midwestern people who they can rely on. But I thought the conference was a very good conference, and I think that anybody gets a chance to go, that they should.
And Mr. Isaac, where's the conference next November?
Detroit.
Detroit?
Yes.
Oh, Detroit is very interesting. I was just reading about how they are a city that is downsizing, that they've gone from like 2 million people to 680,000. And so they're trying to develop more compactly and return some of the suburban or surrounding areas that are, you know, dilapidated housing, tear the housing down and make that into farmland or forestry or something. So, you know, it's kind of a sad story, but maybe a chance to kind of reform Detroit. And do you have a topic yet?
Not yet. We're certainly have begun the conversations about where we might focus. We're going to be in Detroit November 15th and 16th. we are looking at a theme related to either the role of higher education in the revitalization of automotive communities or broadening that to look at how higher education might help revitalize communities that have been based on a single dominant industry.
Seems kind of appropriate.
Right. And to look at institutions as examples that have done a lot of that good work and are invested in the community to really inspire that change.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much once again. Okay. Next we have Minskew. I'd like to invite Laura King. I know she has to leave us shortly, so we'll let her start out to talk a little bit about Minskew's purchasing procedures, especially after we heard from what MEC does.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. With me is Steve Godnowski, who is a member of our staff in the Chancellor's Office, and Michael Noble Olson, who is the Purchasing Manager at Minneapolis Community and Technical College.
Great. Welcome. And Ms. King, if you need to leave, please do. And I'm sure these gentlemen can continue if we have more questions.
I have every confidence, Madam Chair, that they can continue. I'm just going to make a few remarks, and then I'm going to turn it over to Steve and Mike. I was particularly taken with Mr. Isaac's remark about how he's seeing some institutions sort of pull inward as budgets have shrunk, because we have taken just the opposite strategy. We started this initiative that Steve and Mike will talk about 5 or 6 years ago, and have really put effort into it in these intervening years. The chancellor's office, represented here by Steve, and about half of his time on an annual basis at the most, acts as a sort of collaborative partner with the campuses.
And this is central office, right?
That's right, in the chancellor's office.
I'd bring that up.
We have less than, and I didn't even ask Steve this question, maybe it's 25% of his time, because he also has responsibility for all the tax compliance for the system, all of our colleges and universities. So he has a regular job, but as we went through downsizing in the chancellor's office and we had some layoffs, I asked him to pick up this responsibility as well. And he's done really just a terrific job with it. We act as collaborative partners with the campuses. We facilitate through a group that Steve and Mike will talk about in identifying and exploiting opportunities for purchasing value on behalf of the system. We received some questions from your staff this morning, and I'll address one of them, and then I'll sit back and Steve and Mike can tell you about the overall program. The question that came to us was, what is our relationship with the Department of Administration? And I'll just say a bit about that. We have been very steady partners with the Department of Administration really since the merger. And we have relationships with them in a couple of areas that are quite strong, most notably with the Office of Enterprise Technology. We are a vital partner, I would say, with the Office of Enterprise Technology, with the statewide network, with the Centrex system, and with the purchase of network bandwidth for the whole state. I think you've had presentations here in the past, and you've seen a map of the state that shows all these arteries running off of it. The Office of Enterprise Technology manages a statewide network, and we're one of the buying partners with them, and our campuses, in many cases, are the hub of that network in that region of the state. So that's probably the most significant partnership we have with them. We also use Admin's risk management services for all of our property casualty insurance services. We work with them on what are called COPE reviews, which are teams of experts that go out to the campuses and do compliance reviews around energy, around insurance, around OSHA, emergency management, compliance with the insurance provisions. We also use the State Designer Selection Board for all of our construction, architectural selection process. And we've also, in the last year, become more and more interested in a new program that Admin has launched called PBEEP, which is PBEEP, I think. Kent, did I get that right? PBEEP. It's a joint collaborative with Admin and Commerce that has been developed to replace the energy services that they used to provide. We're quite interested in that program. We think it's quite attractive, and it provides great opportunity for our campuses to improve their energy consumption and their energy purchasing program. So, Madam Chair, that's sort of at the Admin level of your questions. And then if I might, I'd like to turn to Steve and Mike to talk about how we approach purchasing more broadly across the colleges and universities.
I'm Michael Noble Olson. I'm with Minneapolis Community and Technical College. I'm the purchasing manager there. And like Laura said, the group that I participate in, it's a MinSCU-wide initiative called the Collaborative Sourcing Team. It's been active, I think, for maybe a couple of years, 2.5 years.
What is sourcing? I mean, why that word sourcing? What does that refer to? Like source of purchaser?
Yeah, looking for ways to purchase, procure, contract with just various
it's
services,
the new word
products.
Too.
Yeah. We tried to come up with a word that covered a wide range of things, because
right.
We do address a number of issues. So.
Okay.
And collaborative, of course, obviously, we're mm-hmm. It's all of the campuses working together along with the central office in St. Paul here. And the idea was to look at ways of leveraging the power of the whole system rather than each school doing its own purchasing. there are certain kinds of purchases where it makes sense that multiple schools work together rather than each doing its own RFP or request for bid or that kind of thing. So, and it also is a way of getting a better pricing, better service by leveraging the multiple institutions. So,
with the joint purchasing that you do, are you able to be very timely? I mean, do you have campuses complain that it's too bureaucratic or it's too slow, or are you able to be pretty swift?
Well, I would say that I think we've been actually pretty good about responding to timelines. One of the things we've done, the collaborative sourcing team includes members from not every school, but representation is statewide. And part of the collaborative sourcing team's activities include a lot of communication, not just at their own, at each school, you know, where the members are, but all of the schools, to talk about what kinds of purchasing they're anticipating, maybe plan ahead, communicate about what kinds of needs are coming down the road, and try and sort of leverage that to avoid, you know, things happening that somebody needs something at, you know, with a very quick turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
If there is something that's needed with a quick turnaround, this, you know, there's also ways that we can expedite something through the process if we need to. And one of the things we do, it doesn't always involve having to go out for a bid or RFP. One of the things the collaborative sourcing team has done is we've spent a lot of time reviewing existing contracting agreements through the Department of Administration, like Laura mentioned. We've got MEC, we've got E&I Cooperative, which is a national educational purchasing cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And there's various other compacts, too, that we use. And sometimes what we need to purchase is actually available through one of those compacts or contracts.
So you can use that and not reinvent the wheel, have to do your own contract.
Right. And that's, that, like I say, that's actually been one of a major effort that we've gone through, is reviewing those existing agreements to see what kinds of things are available there that we don't, so we can avoid that, having to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
Madam Chair, there's really been two strategies here. One has been to identify the agreements that are in place and the programs that are in place, communicate their availability, streamline our internal processes or paperwork if necessary, so that a buyer sitting out on a campus that needs to buy 10 computers can go on a website that these guys have built,
mm-hmm.
find out who's already done the bid, who's offering the computers, compare prices among the different contracts, and place the order right at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
That's been probably the most powerful strategy, because a lot of work has been done by others to bid these, to run RFPs, price the products, and create the catalogs. The other part of the strategy has been to identify things that we want to go through that effort for directly ourselves. And Steve will talk a little bit about that. So it's been a two-legged strategy. We don't have buyers in St. Paul. We don't take delivery in St. Paul and then put it on a truck and send it out to the campuses. The buying is all done at the campus. And so what, other than the buying, we do directly for our own purposes.
You negotiate the contract.
We might negotiate a group-wide contract.
Mm-hmm.
We might put the campus in touch with a contract that's already in place,
mm-hmm.
that they can access.
Okay.
And that, as Michael said, that's the more typical model, because there's a lot of very good work out there already done, like the work you heard from MEC about.
Mm-hmm.
MEC has been very aggressively into computer hardware RFPs, and they've been useful to us. So we just tap their contract, mm-hmm. and don't have to do it ourselves.
Mr. Gednalski.
Madam Chair, I just referred to the handouts that I had brought today, and it describes the team made up of members from 2 and 4 year universities and the Office of the Chancellor, and it mentions our mission statement, leveraging the system's purchasing power to obtain best value. And I just refer to the second page where it describes some of the projects that we've worked on. One I'll point out is mattresses. We work with the facilities folks to obtain the specifications of what mattresses they were looking for. Leveraged our purchasing power as a system.
I had to think a minute about why you needed mattresses for the dorms, okay?
Madam Chair, we have 11,000 beds.
Yeah. Okay.
Purchase roughly 2,000 mattresses a year. We leveraged our system purchasing power.
Yes, do you buy TVs? That's the question from Senator Thomasoni.
I'm sure we don't, Senator Thomasoni.
Especially not flat screen.
Student unions.
And obtained a great mattress for a reduced price, and all the residence halls are purchasing from this contract, so that's an example. On the third page, it gives a list of the various cooperative entities that we look outward first of all to see, is there a great value contract that we can just jump on and use that's already been competitively bid. If there isn't one, then we take a look at if it's worthwhile for our system to join together and go out and bid for it. Mm-hmm. As far as our I'll just mention as far as MEC, several of our campus employees and Office of the Chancellor employees are participating on committees with MEC, coming up, generating ideas and working on the RFPs, writing them and reviewing RFPs with MEC. A couple that were mentioned that are of interest to our campuses would be the web conferencing and related services RFP that is currently out there, and the first RFP from the Energy Group on electrical components that will, I think our campuses will be very interested in looking at the results regarding lighting and automated motors from those RFPs. And we look forward to our April CST meeting, collaborative sourcing team meeting, to engage some of the MEC individuals come and collaborate with us on other ideas.
Mr. Godelsky or others, do you think that with the cuts that the system is facing, do you think there'll be more of an interest? This will become more of a trend to try to save costs through some of this joint purchasing?
We've seen it over the last 2 years. Some of the ideas that were brought up 2 or 3 years ago are being revisited. A lot more interest from campuses. Mm-hmm. Just a lot of enthusiasm. People realize that they have to find ways to save costs.
Can you use it at all in the construction projects, or is that not really work because they're kind of probably privately bid and it's up to the construction company to purchase product?
Madam Chair, sort of both would be the answer. We have modeled a similar process in the construction area to establish blanket contracts, mostly in the maintenance area.
Right.
If someone needs to buy cleaning supplies, or they need to get an electrician in for a day,
right,
or if someone needs to come and patch their parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
So we have established internally in the facilities group a list of our contracts that have been pre-RFP, and campuses can just pull off those contracts to short-circuit that part of the process. We can't really do it when we're talking about construction materials.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a good format for a bulk steel order, for instance, for multiple contracts, because the pricing for those contracts is contained inside the project.
Okay. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. King, or gentlemen, to answer this. It was really interesting for me to hear from MEC that they offer the possibility for cities and counties and school districts to do some cooperative purchasing with them. Are there any opportunities for other taxpayer-based organizations or agencies or divisions to work with MNSCU on your cooperative purchasing?
We are including language in many of our RFPs if we go out as a group to allow not only just one of our institutions, but all of our MNSCU institutions to purchase and include languages that other state agencies could use. For example, the best one would be, it's listed in there as computer dispositions. It's a very good contract that we put in place, and we would encourage schools. We are currently working with the Department of Administration. They might use the contract. They're looking at it. So, yes, we'd encourage that.
Senator Sharon?
Let's see. What was I think I was thinking of something else. I lose track of my question when I'm fascinated by the answers to the other ones.
Okay, well, I'm sure it'll come to
you. Yeah, you know, let me just ask another question. I remember. When I hear you talking about this, you know, I'm reading in here about your other potential projects, and you're talking about further leverage purchases with cities, counties, et cetera. And I heard that also from the MHEC in Minnesota, the report that we just heard, and from the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. Are these similar in terms of its functions and its activities? Do they overlap? Are they competing with each other in terms of what you do and your functions in some areas?
Senator Sharon, I would not look at it quite that direction. I think where you do see some overlap is if you look at the third page of our handout. If we were to look at all of these opportunities, you might find that half of these services make available the similar products. And then we have an opportunity to do some price shopping. So it's not so much that we're creating contracts with the same vendors that the others have created contracts with, but rather we're taking advantage of the work that's been done by those ahead of us and avoiding the overlap.
So that's the looking outward rather than inward, rather than feeling like, ooh, we better hunker down and do it all ourselves. It's, hey, the work's been done for us. Let's take advantage of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you. And Senator Pappas, we're looking mostly here at product purchasing, right? Or maybe it might be health insurance in the future sometime, or it might be technological
property,
expertise.
Property insurance.
Property insurance, but it isn't. Although I did hear about the computer bank, the banking of credits,
right?
But different thing.
Yeah, that's a little bit different than purchasing products. But most of this is about really getting the best bang for your buck through a purchasing process.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, most of this is about commodities, mm-hmm. whether it's paper products or. Cleaning supplies or furniture.
Right.
That's right. We're very strong partners with the MNCOR Industries through the Department of Corrections. We have them at our annual meeting every year to show off their new furniture. So it's commodities. It's not much in the way of services, it's at this point it's not health insurance.
And then just one final question.
Sure.
So it wouldn't be through this. Maybe this isn't the right place, but one of the ideas that some of the high school teachers have asked about is a regional or a collaborative approach to testing, which in all sorts of school systems throughout, especially in the rural part of a state, the small schools can't afford the technology expert, the update, the technology testing, going offline for an hour to do testing every day, and have asked about universities providing a regional testing center so that they can partner with universities to do the testing, and maybe the university could use that as an opportunity to show off their institution and invite them to consider them for an educational institution. That kind of shared service approach is a service issue, not a commodity as much. Are you looking at any? Is MNSCU looking at anything like that?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I'm not quite retrieving, but I believe that's happening now in a couple of instances. I recall having heard that some of our universities, particularly, are serving as testing centers, but I can't pull the facts out of my head for you.
I was just thinking about Senator Bonoff's bill, and if that was more geared toward, she called it shared services, rather than joint purchasing of, like we talked about, of commodities.
Madam Chair, as you saw in the legislative auditor's report, very strong endorsement for work that we've got underway already around shared services internally to Minsky particularly. And you'll also recall in the support you showed for the technology investment that a big piece of that technology investment was to put the platform in place so that we could start to share, do virtual work for each other, so that we could have a payroll clerk sitting in Brainerd who was sold part-time to do the payroll for the campus in Alexandria, and they'd never have to move. That's why the technology investment was so important, and we're making strides through Students First to make more of that work possible. It's very important to our rural campuses that you see through the financial audit reviews have chronic difficulty preserving their internal control environments when they're down to two or three staff to do all the different functions. And the OLA report really endorsed that and encouraged us to continue that work. But that's more in the services column than the commodities column.
And I think, do we have you on the agenda to talk about the Student First
initiative?
Although
it's been pushed off. It was Thursday, and now I think it's pending for a new schedule.
Okay.
And we look forward to that.
All right. Great. Okay, any questions for this group of folks, this three? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we're moving on to a topic, although we certainly would be interested in hearing about the University of Minnesota's purchasing procedures at some point, but our next topic is salary freezes and furloughs. We have, but we're hearing both from Lori Lamb from Minsky and from Mr. Fitzenrider from the University of Minnesota. We do have some testimony.
Ladies and gentlemen,
here's my backup.
Who wants to go first? Mr. Fitzenrider?
Madam Chair, I guess I'll dive into this here. For the record, my name is Richard Fitzenrider. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota. I just want to give you some little bit of background on what we did in the current fiscal year with respect to compensation and what our plans are for the fiscal 11 budget that begins July 1. For the current fiscal year, the University of Minnesota froze wages for all employees, all employee groups. That was a hard freeze for our employees. Our bargaining units, for example, did not even receive step increases. So in order to address a very significant, nearly $80 million budget cut from the state in the current fiscal year, we froze wages. It is not the president's desire to freeze wages for a second year in a row. So our budget plan for the second year does include a compensation increase of 2%, a pool of 2%. And I'll come back to that in a minute. When you look at the budget challenge, and I've been in front of this committee before, the university's budget challenge for next year is roughly $132 million. $32 million of that is made up of having to adjust for the budget cut that's coming from the legislature. I think that's probably going to pass. So we have to adjust our current year spending down by $32 million. I know that this committee has heard the number 36, but that's the reduction you're making from the governor's unallotted base. Our fiscal 10 base is actually $3.9 million lower than what the governor and what you have to cut from. So in a sense, we've already cut a little bit of that $36 million. In addition to that $32 million from the state budget cut, we face approximately another $100 million budget challenge. The first part of addressing that challenge, of course, is tuition revenue. And that'll solve, we think, about 35% of that challenge, which leaves us with about $85 million to be solved. As I said, next year's budget plan in that $85 million includes a compensation pool of 2% that we want to deliver to our which we have in fact negotiated with our bargaining units, delivered to our civil service, and for faculty and professional and administrative staff, that'll be delivered on a merit-based approach. Complicating next year's budget for the university is the fact that we have this 27th payroll period. Our biweekly payroll, it just coincidentally now hits us in this biennium, and that adds to our budget challenge another $41 million. The president yesterday and again this morning delivered to the university community a proposed plan for fiscal 11 to address our remaining budget shortfall of about $85 million. And under that plan, employees system-wide would take the equivalent of a 1.15% decrease in pay in fiscal 2011. That's the fiscal year that begins July 1 of 2010 and ends in June of 2011. This is a temporary reduction in fiscal 11 pay, and it would be implemented differently based on our employee groups. In the case of hourly and civil, which includes civil service and union-represented staff employees, this reduction in pay would be implemented in the form of a mandatory 3-day furlough during the last week of December. And doing it in the last week of December facilitates a week-long shutdown of our campuses, except for essential facilities and services, and provides the university an opportunity to save between $300,000 and $400,000 in additional utility savings and energy costs. The 3-day furlough is equivalent, roughly equivalent, to a 1.15% decrease in pay for that staff group. Hourly employees would not be expected to work hours for which their pay has been reduced. So they will be furloughed those 3 days and not be paid. And as I said, the university will be closed. All other employee groups, including all faculty and academic, professional, and administrative employees, will also see a 1.15% reduction in pay, but no reduction in their assigned duties. These employee groups would be expected to address with their supervisor or responsible administrator how their duties will be accomplished during the campus shutdown in late December. Senior administrators system-wide.
Who was that last group?
That's the faculty and professional and academic employees. Senior administrators system-wide, and this includes deans.
And that was still a 3-day furlough?
Well, Madam Chair, it's not a 3-day furlough, but the pay cut of 1.15% is one-time pay cut is equivalent to a 3-day furlough.
Okay.
However, we are not furloughing those employees.
Right.
During that period, they will either have to work out with their supervisor how they'll accomplish their duties off campus, or they'll take vacation time.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, senior administrators system-wide, including deans, associate and assistant vice presidents, vice provosts, vice presidents, vice chancellors, chancellors, senior vice presidents, the presidents, there's about 85 of these individuals, will take an additional 1.15% pay cut, bringing their total temporary reduction in pay to 2.3%. The furlough and one-time pay cuts saves the university approximately $18.5 million, and we, as I said, hope to save an additional $300,000 to $400,000 by closing over the 2010 holiday season. The program also calls for additional voluntary furlough days for all employees if they so choose, up to a maximum of 10 days. In addition, the compensation plan, as I said, calls for a 2% compensation increase. That compensation increase will be delivered July 1 to civil service and bargaining unit employees, but will be delayed 6 months for faculty and professional academic employees to July 1, saving the university's budget an additional $9.7 million system-wide. So the compensation, one of our main strategies to address the shortfall that the challenge we have is, again, 3 days of furlough, equivalent to 1.15% reduction in pay, a 1.15% reduction in pay for all faculty and P&A, and then in a total of a 2.3% reduction for that select 85, as I call them.
And that only saves you $18.5
million? That saves us approximately $18.5
million. And how much more do you expect you'll save through voluntary furloughs?
Madam Chair, it's difficult to guess. Just don't know at this point. We know that, Hennepin County had a volunteer program that they did get some people to volunteer. I think we'll have some, but it's really hard to say how many and in what part of the university that will happen.
So you're not booking that?
We're not booking that number.
Okay.
So with that, Madam Chair, it's just really what the compensation plan is. We froze for the current year. The president does not want to freeze next year, but we are, given the budget challenge, facing some adjustments on a one-time basis to help balance the university's budget.
And the furloughs then are in this current year, upcoming current year's budget, the year in which everything's frozen.
Madam Chair, beginning July 1 of this fiscal year, there'll be a 2% increase for civil service and bargaining.
It was this last year that it was frozen.
It was the fiscal year we're in now that will end June 30th of 2010 in which it was frozen.
So you're doing the 2% pool, but it's in the year when you're doing the pay cut.
And the furloughs, that's correct.
And the furloughs, right.
Yep.
Oh, interesting.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Tomassoni.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fitzenrider, is the 27-week thing, is that included in what you just got done explaining?
Madam Chair, Senators, university employees will receive the 27th paycheck. Our hourly employees earn that, and our faculty and staff will be provided the 27th paycheck as well.
And is that occurs in June?
That occurs in fiscal 11 as well.
But does that have...
Mr. Tomassoni, Senator Tomassoni.
Madam Chair, you said that creates a $41 million problem for you. Is that $41 million addressed in the numbers you just explained to us? Or
it Madam Chair, members, I guess in a way you could say it's partially addressed with the savings of $18.5 million.
And then, Madam Chair, is the...
Senator, Mr. Tomassoni.
Is the next... How come I became a Mr. All?
I know.
I guess that's better than a missus. But anyway, is it 25 weeks, the 25 pay periods the following year? Or
Mr. Fitzgerald.
Madam Chair, Senator, no, this occurs every 11 years, just based on the calendar. And anyone on biweekly payroll experiences this every 11 years. And then it'll go back to 26 pay periods like it normally is. And then it slowly, the calendar moves, and in 11 years it happens again.
So, Mr. Fitzenrider, this is, you're explaining to me the $85 million is your challenge, and so you addressed about $28 million of it through these salary savings strategies, and I'm just curious, what about the rest of it?
Madam Chair, we will make, and units are currently preparing plans for an average reduction of 2.75% in their operating budgets. And those are going in budget hearings right now with units.
Okay, any questions from members of the committee?
Madam Chair, would like to let the committee know that Regent Ramirez is here today and joined us for this discussion.
Great, welcome. Marine Ramirez, Regent Marine Ramirez. Any questions? Regent, did you want to make any comments? As long as you're introduced. Would you like me to move? I'll move on to the list.
You don't have to.
We don't get to hear from regents too much here, once in a while. Mostly it's not you. Okay,
yes.
Welcome.
Well, thank you, Senator Pappas. Only to say that we're committed to working with the administration to solve these problems and try to do it in a way that's as respectful to our university community and staff and students as possible.
And are the regents taking a furlough too?
Yeah. We are not having our April meetings.
Well, there you are.
Madam Chair, I don't believe we compensate them.
I don't believe you do either, but thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. OK, Okay, why don't we then hear from Minsky about their strategies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lori Lamb. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Human Resources at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. It's a pleasure to be here today to try to answer some of your questions. I won't do what Mr. Fitzenreiter did, which is give you the whole budget picture. That would better come to you from Vice Chancellor King, who just ran off to go to our board meeting, who's meeting back in our offices right at this very moment. I will tell you a little bit about what we're trying to do, as well as attempt to answer some questions that staff alerted us to that you might have. And I prepared, at staff's suggestion, which we appreciate greatly, a one-page summary that outlines perhaps some information that might be useful to all of you as you respond to constituent concerns and otherwise. But I'll talk a little bit first about the salary freeze issue and the furlough issue, and then I'll go through a little bit of the handout that I presented, and then certainly be happy to answer whatever questions that I can.
And could you introduce who you have at the table with you?
Certainly I will. This is Jim Lee. He's our System Director for Compensation, and he's here to bail me out if I have any problems here. He's more of an expert on our personnel plan historically than I am, so he's my safety net, so thank you.
And this is Mr. Levy?
Lee.
Just Lee. Okay. Thank you. Okay, proceed.
All right. Mr. Fitzenreiter talked a little bit about, we too have really worked hard over this biennium with salary freezes from an across-the-board base salary standpoint. We're working on that. Obviously, we have many of the contracts for employees that work with us are negotiated by MMB, and we don't control those directly. We certainly have input into that negotiation process, but we take the lead from them. And as you know, in general terms, those contracts all had a salary freeze in the first year of this biennium. And in the second biennium, there were no across-the-board increases or percentage increases, but there generally were steps in the second year for those people who were below the top of the schedule, which from my understanding, and you would want to talk to MMB to be more clear about that, but from Minsky's perspective, that's about half of the folks in those units will be getting a step increase in the second year of the agreement. And the step is anywhere between 2.5% to 3%, for example, in AFSCME, MAPE, MMA, those groups, anywhere from 2.5 to 3.5% for those people who are below the mid-range. For the contracts that we negotiate for faculty, there are no across-the-board increases in any year. There do remain in the faculty agreement for MSCF, that's our college faculty, very limited ability to have lane improvements for faculty who attain additional educational requirements and such, much like a promotion would be in the university system. And then in the university faculty contract, they can still get increases for promotions, academic promotions, say from assistant professor to associate professor, and they can also get some increases for career steps, which were negotiated to address compression issues in our faculty over time, so that once a faculty member achieves 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years of service, they get two steps increase. Those steps for IFO are about 2.4%. This last year, we had about 400 people out of our faculty in the state universities get promoted, and I can't tell you off the top of my head what the number for MSCF was that had lane changes, but it would be a proportionately representative number of those groups. So we're abiding as well by the salary freeze concept from an across-the-board or base salary improvement standpoint. And in addition, with regard to our administrators, our chancellor, our presidents, et cetera, there were no across-the-board increases in either of the fiscal years. There's no enhancements in either of the years for those two. So we're doing our living best to comply with a no-increase provision. And I think if this group hasn't seen it, I'd certainly be happy to provide it. But the document that's prepared by the Subcommittee on Employee Relations that talks about the costs of the contracts, this is being circulated as the contract ratification bill makes its way throughout the various committees, certainly shows that, indeed, the percentage increases, the costs for the Minsky-controlled contracts are lower than the costs of the increases for the state-controlled contracts. And that's something that we've tried very hard to maintain. But on average, you can see from this sheet, and I'd be happy to give you copies of it, But for example, AFSCME is anywhere over the biennium from a 2% increase over the biennium, a 2.9% increase over the biennium and the like. And for our administrative and service faculty, it's actually a negative number. And similarly for administrators, it's 0.28%. So we are in the contracts we've controlled, they are lower than the costs for the state-controlled contracts. So we've been working very hard on that. In terms of furloughs, I want to address that really quickly, and then I'll go to the handout that I provided. We are examining the furlough issue. Certainly, we've heard about what the U of M is attempting to do there and what their plan is there. I would say a couple of things. They have a much larger number of employees at the University of Minnesota, their faculty and their administrative professionals, as well as their administrators, like we have, are all non-bargaining unit employees, so they have a little more latitude over those particular groups than we do with the collective bargaining individuals. Our faculty, both at the college and at the university level, are collective bargained employees, and we have to honor those contracts to the extent we can. With regard to furloughs, for the state-negotiated contracts, we'll be taking our lead from MMB on that, and what they decide to do with regard to that group of employees, we'll be following that. We know there are discussions around going about MMB. I've talked to Barbara Holmes at MMB about what they're doing, and they haven't made any firm decisions about where they're going to head with that, but we will be obviously taking a lead from that. With respect to the groups that we have control over, our two faculty contracts and our administrative and service faculty and our administrator contracts, we're considering furloughs. As I said, though, it's a much smaller number, so the ability of those furloughs to have any sort of long-term economic impact for our organization is simply not as compelling as it is for perhaps for the University of Minnesota. So we're considering that. We're taking a look at it. But at this stage, I do want to say, and I know we have individuals from our two, our state university and our college faculty here in the room, I would say we do believe we have an obligation to honor those contracts, which do set out a specific number of days that faculty are to be paid in a given year. We think furloughs will be a challenge in that environment, but we're continuing to examine that situation. For our administrative and service faculty, they're not a set number of days is not required before it constitutes a layoff, so we may have some more flexibility there, and we certainly do with the administrators. But we have 580 administrators across our system, and again, the savings of furloughs is not going to be something in the $15 million, $18 million range that the U of M is going to see. We estimate if we had every employee in our system on a furlough, every single one to the extent we can, again, those would be the ones we have to defer to MMB on, it's about a $4.5 million savings per day. But that assumes that we can furlough everybody, and we're not at this point comfortable saying that we can or should do that. I would say from all of my conversations and all of our work so far, our campuses are working incredibly hard looking at long-term fiscal sustainability. And as attractive as furloughs can be, they are more of a short-term solution to a financial problem. And so we're trying to balance what are some of those short-term solutions with longer-term solutions. For example, looking at the early retirement incentive that the legislature adopted and gave us last year, and we're having some good success with that. We're trying to do some other workforce planning methods that will yield us more long-term results. So furlough is not completely off the table, but certainly something that we're continuing to look at. Just wanted to make a quick comment based upon a question that Senator Tomasoni had regarding the U's predicament with regard to the 27th pay cycle. I think Mr. Fitzenreiter said it accurately. Every state agency grapples with that. We had ours in 2009. When we had that extra pay period, it does come every 11 years for every state agency. Mm-hmm. And so you have to find a way to fit that into your planning cycle. It just so happens to be falling on the University of Minnesota this year. And in large part, that's because they get paid on a different day of the week than MNSCU does or other state agencies do. And depending upon when January 1st falls, it falls either in one calendar year or the next. So it occurred to them a year after it occurred to us. So we had the same challenges that they do, and it does happen every 11 years.
How much did that cost you then, Ms. Lamb?
You know, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I could get that to you.
Just curious.
Yeah. 45 million.
Mr. Lee says about 45 million. I would guess that's a close number. Other than that, what I'd like to do, again, just because staff alerted us to a couple of questions that you might have, is just briefly tell you what's in the one page, or I guess it's one and a half page handout that I did prepare for you, thinking it might be helpful, and use it if you like. If not, recycle it. That would be my my position on that. But there is often questions that come up to us, and I'm sure to all of you as legislators about, or at least statements that might come up about whether or not we as a system are proportionally reducing staff or whether layoffs are affecting one unit more harshly than another. What I did at the first page of that handout there for you was to produce the data that we use, and please know that we take our obligations under the law for proportional reductions very seriously. So each 2 times a year, we look at how this is taking place, particularly in times of budget deficits where we're changing and moving and trying to do reductions in force and other cost-saving mechanisms. We take these snapshots from our perspective in November and then in March. And the reason we do it that way is because of our academic calendar. November and March are both in the middle of our academic semesters, so those are the dates where we will have the best representation of all of the employees that will be employed at any given time. We have real fluctuations during summer, during the Christmas break, and others, so we want to make sure that we get the numbers based upon the day when we have the best numbers available, so we do that in November and March. But that chart shows you that from November 8th to November 9th, November of 08 to November of 09, what the reductions of employees have been and how those numbers have shaken out. And I think it is telling to look at the numbers. Number one, we will see larger numbers in 10. We don't have, obviously, those 10 numbers, and we perhaps will see larger numbers this March, but we aren't through March yet, so we can't give you those numbers. But I think the numbers are, interestingly, very consistent across the board. And as I said, we are very mindful about how we do this, as state law prescribes that we must reduce the number of supervisors and managers proportionally with the numbers of non-supervisors and managers. And as you can see, the grand total of supervisors and managers, the percentage of reduction is 1.13%, and the faculty and staff total is 1.16%. All of the other numbers are in there for you to be able to take a look at so that you can see how that's going on. So I personally would tell you that I believe we're doing a very good job proportionally reducing positions across the board, not focusing on any one unit, not looking at just faculty, not looking at just staff, but doing it across the board. And it makes sense because as we're making budget reductions, we're really changing the services provided. So those services affect positions in our institutions that really represent all of the work that is done. It isn't just a targeted way to, for example, get rid of all the clerical workers or other things. We need those folks just as much as occasionally we need faculty, just depending upon what programs and services we're offering. I would just make a note to you, it's on the chart there, that when we talk about bargaining unit numbers, that those numbers are what we refer to as a duplicated headcount, meaning anybody who's a member of a bargaining unit counts here. So if we had a faculty member working at three different institutions, they would count as three in this chart because they are members perhaps of three different bargaining units. So it is a duplicated headcount number, but I did put on there that the total FTE for the system in FY09 was 15,515 as compared to what you see up there in the 19,000 and 18,000 numbers, just so that you understand the distinction. So that I hope will help you address some of the questions that you might get about whether or not we're unfairly targeting certain groups with layoffs or other things. The other thing I would just say about that is it's hard to really just talk about layoffs, and I presented this chart in the scope of overall reductions. Layoffs is a real term of art that only applies to employees that have specific contractual rights to continued employment. I would also say it doesn't apply to our university faculty. When we talk about reducing university faculty, we talk about a term called retrenchment, which is if they're a tenured faculty or a probationary faculty member, we retrench them. We don't lay them off. And in addition, we have many employees, administrators, for example, our part-time, our temporaries, et cetera, that don't have any layoff rights. They're generally at-will employees, and it's not that we can't get rid of them or reduce those positions, because we certainly do, but we don't do it through layoffs. So when people ask us to compare layoffs across all units and across all employee groups, it's not always comparing apples and apples, because layoff is a term of art that applies there, which is why I said that this is really about reductions of positions overall as opposed to just layoffs.
Ms. Lamb, what is insufficient work time?
Insufficient work time is a definition under the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, where the person doesn't work enough days or enough hours in a work year to qualify to be a member of a bargaining unit.
So it would be like, for example, adjunct faculty. Or no, that comes under faculty?
Yes, adjunct faculty, but it would also include some of our very temporary employees who work less than 66 days. So adjuncts would be included, and other temporary people who work very few days in a calendar year.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah, I was surprised actually to see that coming down, because I had assumed that when budget times are tough, there would be more use of adjunct faculty and less of full-time professors.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that is an assumption that a lot of people will make. Unfortunately, that doesn't work out to be the reality. The reality is that in all of the services that we provide, I think our campuses understand that we get better, more quality, and more efficient service from full-time employees than we do part-time employees. I would also say that that assumption is sort of balanced out by the fact that since an adjunct or insufficient work time employee doesn't have a right to continued employment, we can tell them thank you very much for your service, but don't return next semester, easier than we can with a full-time employee who oftentimes has layoff or retrenchment rights. So you'll see some high numbers in that going down because of the ease at which we can make those adjustments to help affect the bottom line in terms of our salary costs. Does that help?
Yep.
Okay.
And the reason for you have a reduction in employees at IFO, which is the four-year college faculty union, and an increase in employees at MSCF, and is that because of the additional enrollment at the two-year colleges? Is that why
yes.
you're seeing that?
Madam Chair, yes, that would be because we're needing more faculty at the two-year colleges right now because, as you know, we've grown by about 18,000 students over time, so somehow someone's got to teach those students in those rooms. So, yes, there's been a slight increase at the colleges, and there will be a decrease at the universities over time. Their enrollments are not up at the same rate that the colleges are.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Ms. Lamb? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lamb, I really think that it's helpful that you're sharing this information with the committee today. My suggestion further would be often the questions that we have surrounding the data that you've provided here come to us from our individual campuses. Mm-hmm. And so any efforts that you could make from the central office to further or more clearly communicate this to your various campuses and the staff at those campuses, I think would be well received, and I think would be helpful to everyone.
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, thank you. I think that's an excellent suggestion, and we will do everything within our power to follow up on that.
Okay, Senator Sharon.
Just to follow up on that, is this possible to get this sent to online so that I can distribute it to as people ask me about this question, that I can shoot it back? I mean, I get specific inquiries about this particular question. That's why you're speaking to it.
Senator Sharon, we can scan it and send it to you.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I'd also be happy to send it electronically if that would be easier. Whatever, we can send it to the staff electronically and they can distribute it that. Whatever makes it easiest for you, we'd be happy to accommodate. Just a couple other things mentioned in there on salaries. Again, I think one of the things that we hear about periodically is MNSCU is increasing the salary of administrators more than they're increasing everybody else. And And the data just does not support that. I even quoted in here a little excerpt from the Office of Legislative Audit report that says actually the MNSCU administrator salaries are going up less than the average salaries for other negotiated agreements. And I would also say that, again, as I said earlier, the administrators and the administrative and service faculty in the contracts under which we control or the plans under which we control didn't receive base salary increases and other increases as other contracts did. So we have done very much within our power and authority to try to keep those at a minimum. And I think, again, as you said, we'll do as much as we can internally to circulate this information, but I think the data just doesn't support the fact that we're increasing administrator salaries more than we are increasing other salaries. In fact, the data is just the opposite. I also just put in a little bit of information on there to help you out on the performance pay provisions, if that's of interest to you. But other than that, I'm happy to stand for any other questions you might have.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming today and to testify, and thank you for your comments, Mr. Lee. We had some people who wanted to testify, and I'd like to see if Ms. Phyllis Walker is here. And then, Mr. Sampson, I'd really like to hear from you if the faculty has agreed to the furlough, because I heard that you were meeting to discuss it. Ms. Walker, welcome to the committee. I don't think we've had you here before, so welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just introduce yourself for the record,
please. I'm Phyllis Walker, and I'm president of AskMe Local 3800, representing the clerical workers at the University of Minnesota. I'm also a 25-year employee of the University of Minnesota. I've been in the university's law school finance office for over 20 years. And I'm here to talk to you today about higher education. Higher education is in crisis all over the country, and part of the reason is because of cuts in state funding, and part of the reason is because of skyrocketing administrative salaries. At the U of M, there are over 250 employees who make over $200,000 a year. You will never see such exorbitant salaries at state, county, or city governments. At the University of Minnesota, the very people that you are supposed to be serving, the students, have seen their tuition increase by 100% since 2000. As a result, working families can no longer afford to send their children to their land-grant institution. Students from working families are graduating with such massive debt that they will be paying for their education for the rest of their lives. You should also know that at the U of M, 100 frontline staff have been laid off in the last year in an effort to balance the budget. It's hard for me to see how that will ever help if over 250 administrators make over $200,000 a year. Instead of cutting the salaries of the people at the top, the university is talking about forced furloughs as a way to solve their budget problems. Furloughs that put many of the frontline staff in financial crisis. Now, if the university is serious about cutting costs, they must eliminate recurring costs. If they don't eliminate recurring costs, then you will be in the same position next year, and we'll be hearing again about forced furloughs. Forced furloughs are not the answer because they do not eliminate recurring costs. The way for the U to realize permanent savings is to eliminate some of the overpaid administrators at the top. Now, in an effort to work with the university and to help them solve their budget problems, AskMe proposed to the university, to Carol Carrier, one of the top administrators at the U, we proposed to her a couple of weeks ago that the university implement voluntary leave of absences rather than forced furloughs. We recommended that because we knew in 2009 that AskMe recommended that in Hennepin County, and it worked. Hennepin County was able to realize more of a savings than what they had originally tried to realize. Forced furloughs disproportionately hurt the lowest paid people. That's why we are against them. That's one of the reasons we are against them. Now, you know, you may look at 3-day salary and say, well, That's no one's going to go broke by giving up 3-day salary. But if you make $14, $15, $16 an hour, that'll put you in financial crisis. I can guarantee that. Our members are living on the edge. Another problem with the forced furloughs is if you mandate that people have to take off 3 days, you're going to make them angry, and they'll only take off 3 days. If it's all voluntary leave of absences, I know that the university community will pull together, and the higher paid people will step up and will take off the days that are necessary for the U to solve some of their budget problems. You know, in closing, I would just like to say that Ask Me Local 3800 proposes that the U cut the salaries and the numbers of the people who make over $200,000 a year, because this will cut recurring costs, which is really what they need to do. And in addition, voluntary leave of absences, we recommend that instead of forced furloughs, because forced furloughs hurt the lowest paid people the most, and voluntary leave of absences allow the U community to work together and to stand up for each other to solve this economic problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walker. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much. And Mr. Sampson, would you mind?
My name is Martin Sampson. I'm a liaison from the University of Minnesota faculty to the legislature. I'm also in the political science department. The last meeting of the University Faculty Senate, which I think was the 5th of March, there was extensive discussion of the furlough idea. An unusual extra meeting of the University Faculty Senate is scheduled for the 25th of this month to vote yes or no on the faculty part of the furlough idea. The Faculty Consultative Committee, which is the top level of faculty governance, in fact, had a lengthy meeting yesterday to discuss aspects of this. There are a number of complications. Along the way, I think the leadership of the FCC expressed some concerns about the furlough concept. In part, there are some faculty on 12-month contracts. There are others on 9-month or 12-month appointments, other on 9-month appointments. The furlough hits people differently. If you're losing 3 days on a 9-month thing, that's slightly more expensive than losing 3 days on a 12-month contract. And I think the suggestion was, why not just take a percentage? Well, that's what has now happened. The administration's proposal is to go in that direction. What will happen the 25th, I don't know. What drives this is that the Constitution, if you will, pertaining to faculty governance, requires that in this kind of situation, the administration come to the faculty and receive the approval of the Faculty Senate for a cut in our pay. And that's essentially what's driving the meeting on the 25th of December, or of March, sorry. In general, my sense is that most faculty expect to be making financial sacrifices of some kind to help the university get through a very, very difficult time. I think there's a sense as well that the really hard part is ahead of us. What exactly this is going to look like, what it should look like, is a source of debate and discussion among university faculty.
Any questions for Mr. Sampson? Senator Corn.
Mr. Sampson, so if the Senate, your faculty Senate, votes and says to the administration that no, we're not in favor of taking a pay decrease, then what does the administration do then?
Administration says it has a plan B. I don't know what the plan B is. The administration finds that money in some way other than cutting the faculty salary. I must say that part of the discussion, there's a lot of discussion about what the form of this should be. And there are people who are arguing that really the increase should be, that there are ways in which a larger increase might be appropriate. Part of the ambiguity, I think, for the faculty is we don't know what's happening in the next fiscal year. Nobody knows for sure what's happening. And so there's, I think, a sense of frustration that it would be very nice to figure out how to make moves that are going to sufficiently address what's coming down the road. And you really can't do that because you don't know what's coming down the road.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Mr. Sampson, does the faculty understand what's happening? And I don't mean to sound like I'm being a smart aleck, but know what's happening in the real world out, like in my district where I have 20% unemployment in Brainerd, and if people have a job, they're one of the few lucky ones. And a lot of the employers in my area have, and I can't speak for other Senate districts, but they've done something similar to a furlough, a day off, or even the Brainerd Dispatch, all the employees had to take a 7% decrease. That's what's happening in what I call the real world. I hope that everybody realizes that. And yes, I understand how important education is, but we are in some difficult times. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, I think the answer is yes. That I mean, many of us know people who are laid off. There's no question, but that we are in a special status, and I think that goes along with, as I see it, a special obligation we have to contribute to the future of the state and so forth through the kinds of things that we do. I think I come back to this point about it's if you don't know what's coming down the road, it's very difficult to come up with some sensible understanding of what kinds of adjustments are going to, for instance, protect non-faculty jobs, and that's something that faculty care very much about. What kinds of adjustments are going to enable the university to continue doing what it's obligated to do in regard to undergraduate education and research and so forth, and still do that at a quality level that previous generations of Minnesotans invested in to make possible at the University of Minnesota.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
Mr. Sampson.
Martin Sampson.
Mr. Sampson. Mr. Sampson, if there's any question, right now we have $1 billion deficit that we're looking at, and in the future, it's $5 billion. We do know what's coming.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I don't think there's any question about that. Exactly what happens with the higher education bill, however, is somewhat less clear. I mean, hugely difficult things certainly are coming down the track. There's no question about that. What exactly is the university going to have to do to adjust and to still be regarded as a prominent university once we get past this, assuming that there is some sunlight at the end of this? The details, I think, are not entirely clear.
Does anyone remember what our deficit was in 2003? 2003, we had $4 billion?
$4.5 billion.
The university saw a cut of 15%
right. That
year. And then we actually did try to backfill that, the next two bienniums after that, with increases of 7 and 8%. But we're still at the 2006 level. We know that. So we're not sure what's going to happen next year, but it's probably going to be ugly.
Yes.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Madam Chair, and to your point as well, in 2003, it's my understanding that that little recession we went through went down really fast and recovered really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to start putting money back fairly quickly into the system due to cuts. This recession is going to go down harder and have a very long, slow recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for what I'm hearing from state economists and leadership and NPR reporting and other experts in finances, it may be 5 or 6 years before we're able to even start thinking about putting.
Also, most of our institutions use tuition to solve most of that problem. That year, I don't remember what the university did. And that's less of an option because tuition is already so high for students. Because tuition has continued to increase. They didn't get a reduction in the ensuing years. Senator Coring.
And then I would also remind the committee in 2003, things were a lot different. We had the $1 billion tobacco endowment fund, which we spent. And we had $500 million in the cash reserve account, and we spent that. And so all these little accounts, we pretty much, they were gone. And so when the drawer is empty, and so when we go to the drawer next year, there's going to be no tobacco endowment fund to take. So that's unfortunate.
Okay, thank you for those.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Lynch, we started.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up on the point that Senator Coring was made that I think was very well founded. And Mr. Sampson, in your testimony, you mentioned something about some special status. I'm not sure what that means, but I can tell you in the private sector, over and over, every single week, I have people in my office that work in the private sector that have lost their jobs, that are on furlough, that are working less than 40 hours a week. I would argue there's no constituency that's immune from the budget challenges that we face. And I think it's fair that we all step up and recognize the role that we might take in this. We don't hear in this committee, or frankly in this building, often enough from the impacts that the budget challenges have on the private sector. And the public sector is not alone in this.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Sampson.
I'm not in disagreement, certainly, with the spirit of what you're saying. By privilege, what I meant is I have a tenured position, and I'm in a very different situation from people in the private sector. It's also a career choice I made, which I won't go into. So far, I think what's happened is that we have a lot of open positions that's affecting what we do. Mm-hmm. There's a pay freeze. That's very different from not having a job. I certainly don't disagree with you. The big picture that troubles me, and I'm at the end of my career, so, I mean, it's not a personal thing for me, but it's a very big worry. It's not a personal thing in the sense of what I do next year or the year after. It's a very deep worry in the sense of what I'm committed to, namely the concept of a first-rate public research university. And all across the country, this concept is under huge stress. Somehow, Minnesota's got to figure out how to get itself through this in a way that leaves us still having a first-rate public research university. Otherwise, the implications for the high-tech part of the economy, the implications for a lot of the rest of the economy of the state, I think are very, very serious.
Senator Sharon, and then we're going to move on. We actually do have a bill to deal with.
I just want you to have an opportunity, Mr. Sampson. Thank you, Senator Pappas. It's really following up on other comments, but we do hear this issue of tenure and collective bargaining as being a major reason why we can't have the flexibility we need in order to accomplish reorganization of how you're spending in a way that we can still achieve the goals that you're describing of good outcomes, higher graduation rates. And oftentimes the focus is placed on collective bargaining and tenure as a critical problem in higher education. And I just want you to speak to have a chance to speak to that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think for a research university where part of the mission is doing research, you need guarantees of longevity. You need there certainly are cases where people need a protection of academic freedom. And I think that's part of what is at the core of the concept of tenure, that you reach a certain level, you then are given a status where you can do something on a research front that doesn't work out. It doesn't cost you your job. You can do something that may be controversial. Again, it doesn't cost you your job. And for better or for worse, I think that's been part of the essence of the concept of universities as well as colleges in the U.S. higher education system.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate those comments. Senator Senjum. Are you just stretching?
No, I just feel...
Hoping you're just stretching, but please comment.
If I just have a minute, then it's not directed to the witness. It's... kind of life experience, and I had the great honor and privilege to work for over 40 years for Mayo Clinic, and along those ways, there was a particular time, I think it was in 1980, where, and I can talk about Mayo more freely now that I'm retired, but institution's premier first administrator. His name was Harry Harwick, had passed away. And there was a big ceremony for Harry in the courtyard there at in the lobby of Mayo. And as a matter of fact, help me, Harry Blackman, the Supreme Court Justice, was talking about Harry. And he talked about Harry relevant to the 1930s and how Mayo then, as a relatively young institution, was facing the Depression, not unlike anybody, you know, every other corporation probably in America. And he talked about, and this isn't genius, I don't suggest that it is, but how that organization at that time collectively all agreed to take a 10% salary reduction. And as Mr. Hoffman, or Mr. Blackman talked about that, he talked about it in the sense that how then in hindsight they were able to look back at that. And how that held the institution together, how that brought people together, and how that enabled the institution to weather that storm and move forward stronger than ever. I'm just believing that as we go through forward into the next 2 years, that conversations along that line are probably going to have to occur, and we're going to have to come together as people and as organizations and make this system work. It's not going to be easy, but there will be sacrifice, and to the extent we can do it collectively and together, I think we'll all be better off for it. So, end of comments.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Senator Tomasoni.
Real quickly, because that could be a solution. But I think Ms. Walker's point is that people on the high end of the scale can afford a little bit more than the people on the low end. And, I mean, if you look at just somebody making $200,000 and you give them a 2% cut at 250 people, you get $1 million. But if you give them a 5% cut, you get $2.5 million. And the point being that I think they have to be sensitive to who's earning what and who can afford to take what kind of cuts. And that, you know, if you have 250 people making over $200,000 and some of them are up in the millions, you know, they can afford to have a little bit more than somebody who's only making $35,000 or $40,000. And I think that should be a consideration.
I know. We could have been in finance.
Mr. Sampson, and then we're going to stop because then we only have 9 minutes or
Madam Chair, members of the committee. That's exactly one of the points I think that troubles a lot of faculty, and it's possible that you could have a no vote, not because people don't want to on the 25th of March, not because people don't want to sacrifice, but because they don't like the concept that the administration has presented. And I think it's going to take a while to get to the kind of point that Senator Senjum is and that you have referred to.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Sampson. Members, I just want to correct something, an announcement I made in the beginning of the meeting, and that was that we were officially in the policy committee. Actually, that was incorrect. Oh, we are officially in the finance division because Senator Saltzman's bill, Senator Saltzman, do you want to come forward now, is actually in the finance division, and we didn't have any other bills, so we actually can be in the finance division the entire time. Senator Saltzman has Senate File 2941. Welcome back. And Senator Saltzman, we're just looking at Section 2 of your bill. And we have an issue with the university having autonomy. And so we don't usually require that the university does anything, but we request. So Mr. Fuller has worked on an amendment that would incorporate also your A2 amendment.
Very good, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank Mr. You. Fuller.
Madam Chair, on the bill, line 1, I'll read what it will be. The Extension Service to the University of Minnesota, delete shall, is requested to adopt a policy authorizing participant fees imposed on a 4-H program in a county to be used for the cost of providing a 4-H education in that county. Get rid of delete the period, including consideration of a policy authorizing fees that provides that participants may provide, and it reads the way it is for the rest of the amendment.
Okay, then Senator Sharon will move that amendment as the A2 amendment. Any comments? Then all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then Senator Saltzman. Did you have any other comments that you'd like to make? This bill, if it passes, will then go to the full finance committee.
Right. Well, if you've adopted, I just want to thank you for that. This is certainly something to follow up on your previous conversation. 4-H may seem like a very different program when you're talking about the entire university system, but you know, 4-H is very, very important to the agricultural you know, history of our state. And when we've talked about high-tech areas, we've heard repeatedly as this bill has moved through, it's very simple. It appears very simple. This is its third stop. But I guess hearing from people that in the state of Georgia, because of budget issues, they have essentially closed their 4-H extension program. And we hear repeatedly that the importance of 4-H in our young people's lives, not only in terms of leadership, but in terms of many of the other areas. And so I think we need in the future to have a broader discussion of how we fund these programs as local counties may be looking at making cutbacks because of decisions made here in this building. So this is to give them some other options in terms of, you know, fundraising. And Mr. Olson is here, if you just say a few words, because this is his fourth or fifth trip to the Capitol to really work it, because this is an issue for Washington County, as our county did cut funding. And if you'll notice in this amendment, we're asking them to continue to have buy-in, that if we're going to allow participant fees, the county has to be involved as well. So this is not perceived as an option for counties to opt out of funding 4-H, but it's giving them a little more flexibility in terms of how we raise funds.
Mr. Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David Olson. I'm the Executive Director of the Washington County Fair. We are quite concerned with the loss of 4-H funding. At our county fair, 8 out of 12 buildings on the fairgrounds are occupied by 4-H activities. Those activities are the ones that draw in most of the families, the animals, the demonstrations, food. We really look at the county fair as a major small business improver, allowing a lot of small businesses to get their foot in the doors into the communities. We see 4-H as a strong leader in getting youth into science and technology. We do have some needs. We have some county commissioners who have, nicely want to put it, a dislike and a distrust of the university system, and that has been a major hurdle for us, being that 4-H is under the governance of the University Extension Program. We were quite distraught. We knew budget cuts were coming. We were thoroughly braced for a 20-30% cut. A complete 100% bailout on the county commissioners was not expected and was quite devastating to our youth. We have lost some youth to other counties because they're not sure if Washington County is going to continue to survive. Our county fair is going to continue to survive. We're also lost a number of youth because once the county has eliminated funds, we've had to go to some extreme fundraising activities and fees. And it's pretty much devastated our lower-income family members in Washington County. It's eliminated them out of our program, and that's a sad thing that I didn't want to see. I've really seen 4-H as a great place for youth of all different kinds of backgrounds, race, color, religion, monetary, to get together, learn, become better citizens, and help the community. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify?
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I this bill was heard in Ag and Veterans Affairs, and I didn't say anything in there, and it passed out. We took a lot of the things out of there in Agriculture Committee, but I just want to let you know, Senator Salzman, that I don't support this. I think... you have one. I think what the Agriculture Society in Washington County should have been doing or should be doing is forging a relationship with the county board, letting them know how important this is, rather than coming to the legislature to do this now. I just don't agree with that. In Crow Wing and Morrison County, where I represent, the county commissioners know how important this 4-H is. And so, we got one county that has a problem, and now we're running to pass a law. And I think it sets a bad precedence. I've talked to Farm Bureau. I've talked to Farmers Union. Tom Peterson is here, and they have concerns with it. And I just think it's a road that we don't want to go down. And I would just urge the committee to vote no. I just think it's a bad idea. And I'm sorry, Senator Saltzman. I think you're a great senator, and you're working hard for your constituents. But I just don't support you on this.
Senator Saltzman.
You know, I appreciate that, Madam Chair, and Senator Corrine. And that is why I have, at each stop, I've tried to incorporate the input. And I think there is, in a sense, a bit of a maintenance of effort built into this. And I have called my county commissioners and alerted them that, they're not getting off scot-free here. In other words, that, we're down here looking at some options because some of our local communities, we haven't talked about, the first provision, but have said we would like to be able to fund 4-H because in some, in some cities they have recreation programs. They fund youth programs in St. Paul, in Hugo, Minnesota, which is not my community. They wanted to contribute because they saw this as a viable youth program but couldn't, assist with that. So, I think that we're trying to look at this. And while it may be Washington County now, and I've tried to be very sensitive that this is not perceived as, this is our way out. This is a way for, counties to defer on this. We want to keep them involved, and we want to have a broader discussion so we aren't the next Georgia. Because I think we are going to be making some more cuts. I just heard the last discussion. Things are going to be different on the other side of this recession. And we absolutely have to have a stronger advocacy for 4-H. And I'm very open to that discussion. In the meantime, once a program is gone, it's really hard to bring it back. Whether it's Washington County or it's another county, if it was someone else's county, I might say we need to do some work there, but can we let this program just go away?
And Madam Chair.
It seems to me, Senator Corrine, that it's voluntary. And maybe I'm reading it wrong, that if a county and the 4-H program are working just fine, then it's fine. If there's some issues where the county is struggling to have the money to pay for it, but it can maybe pay for 50%, and they're willing to use participant fees, then they could go that option. It's just asking the Extension Service to have a policy to allow that to happen.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that. I just think it just sets a bad precedent.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Wieger?
Madam Chair, if I could, I'd like to move Senate File 2941 as amended, be recommended to pass, and refer to Finance.
Finance. Okay, the motion's been made. Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, the University of Minnesota, have they weighed in on this policy?
Extension Service or the U? Senator Saltzman, have you heard from them?
Yes, Madam Chair. And Senator Lynch, I have worked with them from day one. We had a number of meetings over the interim to talk about this because we, felt we wanted them at the table. I know the university is here today. I have shown them the amendment. I'm not sure if they were going to say they support it, but I believe they may be neutral on it. If they want to testify, they certainly are welcome to. But I have been trying to work with them because they understand the problem. But I think we're all very concerned about long-term funding for 4-H.
Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And no one's a bigger supporter of 4-H than I am as former state officer and club leader and everything else. But I'm just wondering here. I understand the amendment makes sense to me because it says that participants may provide up to 50%, which along with dues or fees – that might be imposed on them, they can do fundraising. But the part on 1.11 does speak quite a bit to fees, and I'm just wondering what kind of fees have we imposed recently? When my kids even were recently in 4-H, I don't think we had any.
Senator Saltzman.
Yes. On this point, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, the issue here is that 4-H does charge fees, but they cannot be used to pay for the 4-H educator. And so what happens when you don't have a 4-H educator, because there is a wonderful program at the U of M, they do fabulous research in youth development, developing the entire curriculum, but then in order for a local program to access those programs, they have to hire a 4-H educator or program person from the University of Minnesota. So the issue is that 4-H can, you know, charge fees, but they can't use those fees to pay for the educator. This would allow them, in if they choose to do this, that they would be able to charge fees that would help underwrite the cost of the educator. So we could have a great program and lots of young people. We could have a wonderful statewide program in 4-H. But if a county doesn't hire the 4-H program staff, then they don't have access to these programs that all of us are paying for. So that's why it's very specific to be used for the cost of providing 4-H educators. So right now there are
fees.
Thank
you. I would like to hear from Tom Peterson. I see he's here. If it would be okay with you, Senator Pappas, and while he's coming up, if it's possible, I'm just wondering, was this a program formally paid for completely by the university that they've extracted their resources from and is really a shift then onto local units of government? Is this a shift of responsibility and funding onto?
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I'm a government director for Farmers Union, and I've only briefly talked with Senator Saltzman about the bill as I've started to look at it more and more. I'm a former club president. I was also a 4-H leader. I went to the University of Georgia and was involved in the Georgia 4-H program and found that out.
And your position on the bill?
And is. I am concerned about it. And more with the amendment, and I'm just concerned about the way 4-H is going in general and the funding that we are putting at. It is unfortunate that Washington County made the decision that they made, and we're trying to address that and what county might be next. So I don't, you know, fault Senator Saltzman for going forward with this. But I do worry about now with the amendment, are we going to actually give counties an extra burden or an extra excuse to move forward and say, oh, well, we can back off as long as we're matching this, we could back down a little bit. And I don't know if that could happen too, because I do know that there are counties that have struggled with 4-H and we've talked to and been able to put out some fires, and the county boards brought it up and in other counties besides Washington. But is, you know, and I'm willing to work with her on the amendment as it goes forward and trying to figure out, because I don't want that to happen either, where we're constantly defending 4-H, which we're going to be doing more and more. And so that's my concern with the bill.
Well, this bill has gone through a lot of changes, and I suppose one more change between here and finance would not be the end of it, I hope. So Senator Wieger makes the motion. All those in, oh, yes. Sorry, we got a little pressed for time here at the end, and we got a little controversy. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hello, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Senior Associate Dean for University of Minnesota Extension at the University of Minnesota. And I just wanted to make one statement in particular, and that's that the University of Minnesota has not shifted any of its funding from state programs down to the counties. That has not happened. I think all of our programs, we have a great program in 4-H. It is really affecting our youth. We're very attentive to this issue as far as county funding. We appreciate the efforts that Senator Saltzman is looking at, and we look forward to working, you know, with the legislature and that to come up with viable options. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Senchum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to perhaps join with Senator Coring on this, and I think about a few counties in my own Olmsted County, where you have a dominant city, and so a county board could well look at this statute, at least perhaps a different one, and suggest since maybe 70% of the people that go to the county fair in Rochester are Rochester people, let's just kick it over there and let the city of Rochester handle it. And likewise, Austin, Albert Lea, where you have a more dominant city in a county that is probably going to more totally engage in that fair itself, why wouldn't a county board just kick it over to the city? I just think it sets up conflict that we don't need.
Okay, all those in favor of the Wieger motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, you're on to finance.
Very much, Madam Chair.
We'll see you there, and the meeting is adjourned.